Chapter 2. Inside the Mindsets. When I was a young woman, I wanted a prince-like mate. Very handsome, very successful, a big cheese. I wanted a glamorous career, but nothing too hard or risky. And I wanted it all to come to me as validation of who I was. It would be many years before I was satisfied. I got a great guy, but he was a work in progress. I have a great career, but boy, is it a constant challenge. Nothing was easy. So why am I satisfied? I changed my mindset. I changed it because of my work. One day, my doctoral student, Mary Bandura, and I were trying to understand why some students were so caught up in proving their ability, while others could just let go and learn. Suddenly, we realized that there were two meanings to ability, not one. A fixed ability that needs to be proven, and a changeable ability that can be developed through learning. That's how the mindsets were born. I knew instantly which one I had. I realized why I had always been so concerned about mistakes and failures. And I recognized for the first time that I had a choice. When you enter a mindset, you enter a new world. In one world, the world of fixed traits, success is about proving you're smart or talented, validating yourself. In the other, the world of changing qualities, it's about stretching yourself to learn something new, developing yourself. In one world, failure is about having a setback, getting a bad grade, losing a tournament, getting fired, getting rejected. It means you're not smart or talented. In the other world, failure is about not growing, not reaching for the things you value. It means you're not fulfilling your potential. In one world, effort is a bad thing. It, like failure, means you're not smart or talented. If you were, you wouldn't need effort. In the other world, effort is what makes you smart or talented. You have a choice. Mindsets are just beliefs. They're powerful beliefs, but they're just something in your mind. And you can change your mind. As you read, think about where you'd like to go and which mindset will take you there. Is success about learning or proving you're smart? Benjamin Barber, an eminent sociologist, once said, "I don't divide the world into the weak and the strong, or the successes and the failures. I divide the world into the learners and non-learners." What on earth would make someone a non-learner? Everyone is born with an intense drive to learn. Infants stretch their skills daily, not just ordinary skills, but the most difficult tasks of a lifetime, like learning to walk and talk. They never decide it's too hard or not worth the effort. Babies don't worry about making mistakes or humiliating themselves. They walk, they fall, they get up, they just barge forward. What could put an end to this exuberant learning? The fixed mindset. As soon as children become able to evaluate themselves, some of them become afraid of challenges. They become afraid of not being smart. I have studied thousands of people from preschoolers on, and it's breathtaking how many reject an opportunity to learn. We offered four-year-olds a choice. They could redo an easy jigsaw puzzle, or they could try a harder one. Even at this tender age, children with the fixed mindset, the ones who believed in fixed traits, stuck with the safe one. Kids who are born smart don't do mistakes, they told us. Children with the growth mindset, the ones who believed you could get smarter, thought it was a strange choice. Why are you asking me to do this, lady? Why would anyone want to keep doing the same puzzle over and over? They chose one hard one after another. "I'm dying to figure them out," exclaimed one little girl. So children with the fixed mindset want to make sure they succeed. Smart people should always succeed. But for children with the growth mindset, success is about stretching themselves. It's about becoming smarter. One seventh grade girl summed it up. "I think intelligence is something you have to work for. It isn't just given to you. Most kids, if they're not sure of an answer, will not raise their hand to answer the question. But what I usually do is raise my hand, because if I'm wrong, then my mistake will be corrected. Or I will raise my hand and say, 'How would this be solved?' Or, 'I don't get this. Can you help me?' Just by doing that, I'm increasing my intelligence." Beyond puzzles. It's one thing to pass up a puzzle. It's another to pass up an opportunity that's important to your future. To see if this would happen, we took advantage of an unusual situation. At the University of Hong Kong, everything is in English. Classes are in English, textbooks are in English, and exams are in English. But some students who enter the university are not fluent in English, so it would make sense for them to do something about it in a hurry. As students arrived to register for their freshman year, we knew which ones were not skilled in English. And we asked them a key question. If the faculty offered a course for students who need to improve their English skills, would you take it? We also measured their mindset. We did this by asking them how much they agreed with statements like this: "You have a certain amount of intelligence, and you can't really do much to change it." People who agree with this kind of statement have a fixed mindset. Those who have a growth mindset agree that you can always substantially change how intelligent you are. Later, we looked at who said yes to the English course. The students with the growth mindset gave an emphatic yes. But those with the fixed mindset were not very interested. Believing that success is about learning, students with the growth mindset seized the chance, but those with the fixed mindset didn't want to expose their deficiencies. Instead, to feel smart in the short run, they were willing to put their college careers at risk. This is how the fixed mindset makes people into non-learners. Brainwaves tell the story. You can even see the difference in people's brainwaves. People with both mindsets came into our brainwave lab at Columbia. As they answered hard questions and got feedback, we were curious about when their brainwaves would show them to be interested and attentive. People with a fixed mindset were only interested when the feedback reflected on their ability. Their brainwaves showed them paying close attention when they were told whether their answers were right or wrong. But when they were presented with information that could help them learn, there was no sign of interest. Even when they'd gotten an answer wrong, they were not interested in learning what the right answer was. Only people with a growth mindset paid close attention to information that could stretch their knowledge. Only for them was learning a priority. What's your priority? If you had to choose, which would it be? Loads of success and validation, or lots of challenge? It's not just on intellectual tasks that people have to make these choices. People also have to decide what kinds of relationships they want, ones that bolster their egos or ones that challenge them to grow. Who is your ideal mate? We put this question to young adults, and here's what they told us. People with the fixed mindset said the ideal mate would put them on a pedestal, make them feel perfect, worship them. In other words, the perfect mate would enshrine their fixed qualities. My husband says that he used to feel this way, that he wanted to be the god of a one person, his partner's, religion. Fortunately, he chucked this idea before he met me. People with the growth mindset hoped for a different kind of partner. They said their ideal mate was someone who would see their faults and help them to work on them, challenge them to become a better person, encourage them to learn new things. Certainly, they didn't want people who would pick on them or undermine their self-esteem, but they did want people who would foster their development. They didn't assume they were fully evolved, flawless beings who had nothing more to learn. Are you already thinking, uh-oh, what if two people with different mindsets get together? A growth mindset woman tells about her marriage to a fixed mindset man. I had barely gotten all the rice out of my hair when I began to realize I made a big mistake. Every time I said something like, "Why don't we try to go out a little more?" or "I'd like it if you consulted me before making decisions," he was devastated. Then, instead of talking about the issue I raised, I'd have to spend literally an hour repairing the damage and making him feel good again. Plus, he would then run to the phone to call his mother, who always showered him with the constant adoration he seemed to need. We were both young and new at marriage. I just wanted to communicate. So the husband's idea of a successful relationship, total uncritical acceptance, was not the wife's. And the wife's idea of a successful relationship, confronting problems, was not the husband's. One person's growth was the other person's nightmare. CEO disease. Speaking of reigning from atop a pedestal and wanting to be seen as perfect, you won't be surprised that this is often called CEO disease. Lee Iacocca had a bad case of it. After his initial success at head of Chrysler Motors, Iacocca looked remarkably like our four-year-olds with the fixed mindset. He kept bringing out the same car models over and over with only superficial changes. Unfortunately, they were models no one wanted anymore. Meanwhile, Japanese companies were completely rethinking what cars should look like and how they should run. We know how this turned out. The Japanese cars rapidly swept the market. CEOs face this choice all the time. Should they confront their shortcomings or should they create a world where they have none? Lee Iacocca chose the latter. He surrounded himself with worshippers, exiled the critics, and quickly lost touch with where his field was going. Lee Iacocca became a non-learner. But not everyone catches CEO disease. Many great leaders confront their shortcomings on a regular basis. Darwin Smith, looking back on his extraordinary performance at Kimberly-Clark, declared, "I never stopped trying to be qualified for the job." These men, like the Hong Kong students with the growth mindset, never stopped taking the remedial course. CEOs face another dilemma. They can choose short-term strategies that boost the company's stock and make themselves look like heroes, or they can work for long-term improvement, risking Wall Street's disapproval as they lay the foundation for the health and growth of the company over the longer haul. Albert Dunlap, a self-professed fixed mindsetter, was brought in to turn around Sunbeam. He chose the short-term strategy of looking like a hero to Wall Street. The stock soared, but the company fell apart. Lou Gerstner, an avowed growth mindsetter, was called in to turn around IBM. As he set about the enormous task of overhauling IBM culture and policies, stock prices were stagnant and Wall Street sneered. They called him a failure. A few years later, however, IBM was leading its field again. Stretching. People in a growth mindset don't just seek challenge. They thrive on it. The bigger the challenge, the more they stretch. And nowhere can it be seen more clearly than in the world of sports. You can just watch people stretch and grow. Mia Hamm, the greatest female soccer star of her time, says it straight out. "All my life I've been playing up, meaning I've challenged myself with players older, bigger, more skillful, more experienced. In short, better than me." First, she played with her older brother. Then, at 10, she joined the 11-year-old boys' team. Then she threw herself into the number one college team in the United States. "Each day I attempted to play up to their level, and I was improving faster than I ever dreamed possible." Patricia Miranda was a chubby, unathletic high school kid who wanted to wrestle. After a bad beating on the mat, she was told, "You're a joke." First she cried. Then she felt, "That really set my resolve. I had to keep going and had to know if effort and focus and belief and training could somehow legitimize me as a wrestler." Where did she get this resolve? Miranda was raised in a life devoid of challenge. But when her mother died of an aneurysm at age 40, 10-year-old Miranda came up with a principle. When you're lying on your deathbed, one of the cool things to say is, "I really explored myself." This sense of urgency was instilled when my mom died. If you only go through life doing stuff that's easy, shame on you. So when wrestling presented a challenge, she was ready to take it on. Her effort paid off. At 24, Miranda was having the last laugh. She won the spot for her weight group on the U.S. Olympic team and came home from Athens with a bronze medal. And what was next? Yale Law School. People urged her to stay where she was, already on top, but Miranda felt it was more exciting to start at the bottom again and see what she could grow into this time. Stretching beyond the possible. Sometimes people with the growth mindset stretch themselves so far that they do the impossible. In 1995, Christopher Reeve, the actor, was thrown from a horse. His neck was broken, his spinal cord was severed from his brain, and he was completely paralyzed below the neck. Medical science said, "So sorry, come to terms with it." Reeve, however, started a demanding exercise program that involved moving all parts of his paralyzed body with the help of electrical stimulation. Why couldn't he learn to move again? Why couldn't his brain once again give commands that his body would obey? Doctors warned that he was in denial and setting himself up for disappointment. They had seen this before, and it was a bad sign for his adjustment. But really, what else was Reeve doing with his time? Was there a better project? 5 years later, Reeve started to regain movement. First it happened in his hands, then his arms, then legs, and then torso. He was far from cured, but brain scans showed that his brain was once more sending signals to his body that the body was responding to. Not only did Reeve stretch his abilities, he changed the entire way science thinks about the nervous system and its potential for recovery. In doing so, he opened a whole new vista for research and a whole new avenue of hope for people with spinal cord injuries. Thriving on the sure thing. Clearly, people with the growth mindset thrive when they're stretching themselves. When do people with the fixed mindset thrive? When things are safely within their grasp. If things get too challenging, when they're not feeling smart or talented, they lose interest. I watched it happen as we followed pre-med students through their first semester of chemistry. For many students, this is what their lives have led up to, becoming a doctor. And this is the course that decides who gets to be one. It's one heck of a hard course, too. The average grade on each exam is C+, for students who've rarely seen anything less than an A. Most students started out pretty interested in chemistry. Yet over the semester, something happened. Students with the fixed mindset stayed interested only when they did well right away. Those who found it difficult showed a big drop in their interest and enjoyment. If it wasn't a testimony to their intelligence, they couldn't enjoy it. "The harder it gets," reported one student, "the more I have to force myself to read the book and study for the tests. I was excited about chemistry before, but now every time I think about it, I get a bad feeling in my stomach." In contrast, students with the growth mindset continued to show the same high level of interest, even when they found the work very challenging. "It's a lot more difficult for me than I thought it would be, but it's what I want to do, so that only makes me more determined. When they tell me I can't, it really gets me going." Challenge and interest went hand in hand. We saw the same thing in younger students. We gave fifth graders intriguing puzzles, which they all loved, but when we made them harder, children with the fixed mindset showed a big plunge in enjoyment. They also changed their minds about taking some home to practice. "It's okay, you can keep them. I already have them," fibbed one child. In fact, they couldn't run from them fast enough. This was just as true for children who were the best puzzle solvers. Having puzzle talent did not prevent the decline. Children with the growth mindset, on the other hand, couldn't tear themselves away from the hard problems. These were their favorites, and these were the ones they wanted to take home. "Could you write down the name of these puzzles?" one child asked, "so my mom can buy me some more when these ones run out?" "Not long ago, I was interested to read about Marina Semyonova, a great Russian dancer and teacher who devised a novel way of selecting her students. It was a clever test for mindset. As a former student tells it, her students first have to survive a trial period while she watches to see how you react to praise and to correction. Those more responsive to the correction are deemed worthy." In other words, she separates the ones who get their thrill from what's easy, what they've already mastered, from those who get their thrill from what's hard. I'll never forget the first time I heard myself say, "This is hard. This is fun." That's the moment I knew I was changing mindsets. When do you feel smart? When you're flawless or when you're learning? The plot is about to thicken, for in the fixed mindset, it's not enough just to succeed. It's not enough just to look smart and talented. You have to be pretty much flawless, and you have to be flawless right away. We asked people, ranging from grade schoolers to young adults, "When do you feel smart?" The differences were striking. People with the fixed mindset said, "It's when I don't make any mistakes. When I finish something fast and it's perfect. When something is easy for me, but other people can't do it." "It's about being perfect right now." But people with the growth mindset said, "When it's really hard and I try really hard and I can do something I couldn't do before." Or, "When I work on something a long time and I start to figure it out." For them, it's not about immediate perfection. It's about learning something over time, confronting a challenge and making progress. If you have ability, why should you need learning? Actually, people with a fixed mindset expect ability to show up on its own before any learning takes place. After all, if you have it, you have it, and if you don't, you don't. I see this all the time. Out of all the applicants from all over the world, my department at Columbia admitted 6 new graduate students a year. They all had amazing test scores, nearly perfect grades, and rave recommendations from eminent scholars. Moreover, they'd been courted by the top grad schools. It took one day for some of them to feel like complete imposters. Yesterday they were hotshots, today they're failures. Here's what happens. They look at the faculty with our long list of publications. Oh my God, I can't do that. They look at the advanced students who are submitting articles for publication and writing grant proposals. Oh my God, I can't do that. They know how to take tests and get A's, but they don't know how to do this. Yet. They forget the yet. Isn't that what school is for? To teach. They're there to learn how to do these things, not because they already know everything. I wonder if this is what happened to Janet Cook and Stephen Glass. They were both young reporters who skyrocketed to the top on fabricated articles. Janet Cook won a Pulitzer Prize for her Washington Post articles about an 8-year-old boy who was a drug addict. The boy did not exist, and she was later stripped of her prize. Stephen Glass was the whiz kid of the New Republic, who seemed to have stories and sources reporters only dream of. The sources did not exist, and the stories were not true. Did Janet Cook and Stephen Glass need to be perfect right away? Did they feel that admitting ignorance would discredit them with their colleagues? Did they feel they should already be the big-time reporters before they did the hard work of learning how? "We were stars, precocious stars," wrote Stephen Glass, "and that was what mattered." The public understands them as cheats, and cheat they did. But I understand them as talented young people, desperate young people, who succumbed to the pressures of a fixed mindset. There was a saying in the 1960s that went, "Becoming is better than being." The fixed mindset does not allow people the luxury of becoming. They have to already be. A test score is forever. Let's take a closer look at why, in the fixed mindset, it's so crucial to be perfect right now. It's because one test or one evaluation can measure you forever. 20 years ago, at the age of 5, Loretta and her family came to the United States. A few days later, her mother took her to her new school, where they promptly gave her a test. The next thing she knew, she was in her kindergarten class, but it was not the Eagles, the elite kindergarten class. As time passed, however, Loretta was transferred to the Eagles, and she remained with that group of students until the end of high school, garnering a bundle of academic prizes along the way. Yet she never felt she belonged. That first test, she was convinced, diagnosed her fixed ability and said that she was not a true Eagle. Never mind that she had been 5 years old and had just made a radical change to a new country. Or that maybe there hadn't been room in the Eagles for a while. Or that maybe the school decided she would have an easier transition in a more low-key class. There are so many ways to understand what happened and what it meant. Unfortunately, she chose the wrong one. For in the world of the fixed mindset, there is no way to become an Eagle. If you were a true Eagle, you would have aced the test and been hailed as an Eagle at once. Is Loretta a rare case, or is this kind of thinking more common than we realize? To find out, we showed fifth graders a closed cardboard box and told them it had a test inside. This test, we said, measured an important school ability. We told them nothing more. Then we asked them questions about the test. First, we wanted to make sure that they'd accept our description, so we asked them, "How much do you think this test measures an important school ability?" All of them had taken our word for it. Next, we asked, "Do you think this test measures how smart you are?" And, "Do you think this test measures how smart you'll be when you grow up?" Students with the growth mindset had taken our word that the test measured an important ability, but they didn't think it measured how smart they were, and they certainly didn't think it would tell them how smart they'd be when they grew up. In fact, one of them told us, "No way, ain't no test can do that." But the students with the fixed mindset didn't simply believe the test could measure an important ability. They also believed, just as strongly, that it could measure how smart they were, and how smart they'd be when they grew up. They granted one test the power to measure their most basic intelligence now and forever. They gave this test the power to define them. That's why every success is so important. Another look at potential. This leads us back to the idea of potential, and to the question of whether tests or experts can tell us what our potential is, what we're capable of, what our future will be. The fixed mindset says yes. You can simply measure the fixed ability right now and project it into the future. Just give the test or ask the expert. No crystal ball needed. So common is the belief that potential can be known right now that Joseph P. Kennedy felt confident in telling Morton Downey Jr. that he would be a failure. What had Downey, later a famous television personality and author, done? Why, he had worn red socks and brown shoes to the Stork Club. "Morton," Kennedy told him, "I don't know anybody I've ever met in my life wearing red socks and brown shoes who ever succeeded. Young man, let me tell you now, you do stand out, but you don't stand out in a way that people will ever admire you." Many of the most accomplished people of our era were considered by experts to have no future. Jackson Pollock, Marcel Proust, Elvis Presley, Ray Charles, Lucille Ball, and Charles Darwin were all thought to have little potential for their chosen fields. And in some of these cases, it may well have been true that they did not stand out from the crowd early on. But isn't potential someone's capacity to develop their skills, with effort, over time? And that's just the point. How can we know where effort and time will take someone? Who knows? Maybe the experts were right about Jackson, Marcel, Elvis, Ray, Lucille, and Charles, in terms of their skills at the time. Maybe they were not yet the people they were to become. I once went to an exhibit in London of Paul Cézanne's early paintings. On my way there, I wondered who Cézanne was and what his paintings were like before he was the painter we know today. I was intensely curious because Cézanne is one of my favorite artists and the man who set the stage for much of modern art. Here's what I found. Some of the paintings were pretty bad. They were overwrought scenes, some violent, with amateurishly painted people. Although there were some paintings that foreshadowed the later Cézanne, many did not. Was the early Cézanne not talented, or did it just take time for Cézanne to become Cézanne? People with the growth mindset know it takes time for potential to flower. Recently, I got an angry letter from a teacher who had taken one of our surveys. The survey portrays a hypothetical student, Jennifer, who had gotten 65% on a math exam. It then asks teachers to tell us how they would treat her. Teachers with the fixed mindset were more than happy to answer our questions. They felt that by knowing Jennifer's score, they had a good sense of who she was and what she was capable of. Their recommendations abounded. Mr. Reardon, by contrast, was fuming. Here's what he wrote. "To whom it may concern, having completed the educator's portion of your recent survey, I must request that my results be excluded from the study. I feel that the study itself is scientifically unsound. Unfortunately, the test uses a faulty premise, asking teachers to make assumptions about a given student based on nothing more than a number on a page. Performance cannot be based on one assessment. You cannot determine the slope of a line given only one point, as there is no line to begin with. A single point in time does not show trends, improvement, lack of effort, or mathematical ability. Sincerely, Michael D. Reardon." I was delighted with Mr. Reardon's critique and couldn't have agreed with it more. An assessment at one point in time has little value for understanding someone's ability, let alone their potential to succeed in the future. It was disturbing how many teachers thought otherwise, and that was the point of our study. The idea that one evaluation can measure you forever is what creates the urgency for those with the fixed mindset. That's why they must succeed perfectly and immediately. Who can afford the luxury of trying to grow when everything is on the line right now? Is there another way to judge potential? NASA thought so. When they were soliciting applications for astronauts, they rejected people with pure histories of success and instead selected people who had had significant failures and bounced back from them. Jack Welch, the celebrated CEO of General Electric, chose executives on the basis of runway, their capacity for growth. And remember Marina Semyonova, the famed ballet teacher, who chose the students who were energized by criticism. They were all rejecting the idea of fixed ability and selecting instead for mindset. Proving you're special. When people with the fixed mindset opt for success over growth, what are they really trying to prove? That they're special, even superior. When we ask them, "When do you feel smart?" so many of them talked about times they felt like a special person, someone who was different from and better than other people. Until I discovered the mindsets and how they work, I too thought of myself as more talented than others, maybe even more worthy than others because of my endowments. The scariest thought, which I rarely entertained, was the possibility of being ordinary. This kind of thinking led me to need constant validation. Every comment, every look was meaningful. It registered on my intelligence scorecard, my attractiveness scorecard, my likability scorecard. If a day went well, I could bask in my high numbers. One bitter cold winter night, I went to the opera. That night, the opera was everything you hope for, and everyone stayed until the very end, not just the end of the opera, but through all the curtain calls. Then we all poured into the street and we all wanted taxis. I remember it clearly. It was after midnight, it was 7 degrees, there was a strong wind, and as time went on, I became more and more miserable. There I was, part of an undifferentiated crowd. What chance did I have? Suddenly, a taxi pulled up right next to me. The handle of the back door lined up perfectly with my hand, and as I entered, the driver announced, "You were different." I lived for those moments. Not only was I special, it could be detected from a distance. The self-esteem movement encourages this kind of thinking and has even invented devices to help confirm your superiority. I recently came across an ad for such a product. Two of my friends send me an illustrated list each year of the top 10 things they didn't get me for Christmas. From January through November, they clip candidate items from catalogs or download them from the internet. In December, they select the winners. One of my all-time favorites is the pocket toilet, which you fold up and return to your pocket after using. This year, my favorite was the "I Love Me" mirror, a mirror with "I Love Me" in huge capital letters written across the bottom half. By looking into it, you can administer the message to yourself and not wait for the outside world to announce your specialness. Of course, the mirror is harmless enough. The problem is when special begins to mean better than others. A more valuable human being, a superior person, an entitled person. Special, superior, entitled. John McEnroe had a fixed mindset. He believed that talent was all. He did not love to learn. He did not thrive on challenges. When the going got rough, he often folded. As a result, by his own admission, he did not fulfill his potential. But his talent was so great that he was the number one tennis player in the world for 4 years. Here he tells us what it was like to be number one. McEnroe used sawdust to absorb the sweat on his hands during a match. This time the sawdust was not to his liking, so he went over to the can of sawdust and knocked it over with his racket. His agent, Gary, came dashing over to find out what was wrong. "You call that sawdust?" I said. I was actually screaming at him. The sawdust was ground too fine. "This looks like rat poison. Can't you get anything right?" So Gary ran out and 20 minutes later came back with a fresh can of coarser sawdust and $20 less in his pocket. He'd had to pay a union employee to grind up a 2x4. This is what it was like to be number one. He goes on to tell us about how he once threw up all over a dignified Japanese lady who was hosting him. The next day she bowed, apologized to him, and presented him with a gift. "This," McEnroe proclaims, is also what it was like to be number one. Everything was about you. Did you get everything you need? Is everything okay? We'll pay you this, we'll do that, we'll kiss your behind. You only have to do what you want. Your reaction to anything else is, get the hell out of here. For a long time, I didn't mind it a bit. Would you? So let's see. If you're successful, you're better than other people. You get to abuse them and have them grovel. In the fixed mindset, this is what can pass for self-esteem. As a contrast, let's look at Michael Jordan, growth-minded athlete par excellence, whose greatness is regularly proclaimed by the world. Superman, God in person, Jesus in tennis shoes. If anyone has reason to think of himself as special, it's he. But here's what he said when his return to basketball caused a huge commotion. I was shocked with the level of intensity my coming back to the game created. People were praising me like I was a religious cult or something. It was very embarrassing. I'm a human being like everyone else. Jordan knew how hard he had worked to develop his abilities. He was a person who had struggled and grown, not a person who was inherently better than others. Tom Wolfe, in The Right Stuff, describes the elite military pilots who eagerly embrace the fixed mindset. Having passed one rigorous test after another, they think of themselves as special, as people who were born smarter and braver than other people. But Chuck Yeager, the hero of The Right Stuff, begged to differ. There is no such thing as a natural-born pilot. Whatever my aptitude or talents, becoming a proficient pilot was hard work, really a lifetime's learning experience. The best pilots fly more than the others. That's why they're the best. Like Michael Jordan, he was a human being. He just stretched himself farther than most. In summary, people who believe in fixed traits feel an urgency to succeed, and when they do, they may feel more than pride. They may feel a sense of superiority, since success means their fixed traits are better than other people's. However, lurking behind that self-esteem of the fixed mindset is a simple question. If you're somebody when you're successful, what are you when you're unsuccessful?